Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Kraft Foods did not take the day off today, despite its significant presence in our Labor Day cookouts. Velveeta for your burgers, anyone? Or some country time in your glass? No, today it was about chocolate and all the other things Cadbury brings to the world of food. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Barron's, for more than 80 years providing investors ideas and insights on the markets. Barron's, see what others don't. Barron's.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this holiday Monday. It is the 7th day of September. Kraft offered more than $16 billion for the British candy giant Cadbury today, an offer to which Cadbury said, not sweet enough. Kraft says it'll keep trying, but wait, we're in the middle of a global recession, and all we've been hearing about is how companies are broke and nobody can get a loan to do anything, much less take over a competitor. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith takes a look.
A couple of years ago, companies were in a buying frenzy. Then came the global recession. The first half of this year saw mergers and acquisitions nearly drop in half. Now it seems like things might be picking back up. Last week, Disney agreed to buy Marvel Entertainment. Procter & Gamble recently sold off its prescription drug business. And there's word that British Airways might try to buy Lufthansa.
Well, it's certainly quite a positive sign, isn't it?
Aparna Ram is with Seven Investment Management. She says companies are feeling confident enough to go bargain hunting.
By no means is what we saw last year completely over, but we are going to be seeing a lot of companies that have gone through the recession, that have gone through and fixed their balance sheets, and they're going to be looking at other companies within their sectors and saying, who can I buy right now?
But economic consultant Gary Schilling says these buys are not such a good sign. He says companies don't think the global economy will recover anytime soon, and buying competitors is a way to grow when sales are dropping. He says this wave of consolidation is a lot different than the one we saw a couple of years ago.
When there's money freely flowing, there is a tendency to say, hey, let's get bigger, let's get grander, let's build an empire. Now, though, I think it's a very different motivation.
Schilling says when times are good, companies want to buy businesses that will expand their reach into new fields. When times are tight, he says, companies tend to buy competing businesses that can help them build market share, cut costs, and be an opportunity to clean house. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
It is economic crisis anniversary time. 1 year ago today, the federal government seized Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Well, here we are on September 7th, 2009, and how are Fannie and Freddie doing? Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has some answers from New York.
When the government takeover was announced, this was Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson's rationale.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are critical to turning the corner on housing.
Fannie and Freddie own or guarantee almost $5.5 trillion worth of mortgages. The two companies buy loans from banks, package them up, and sell them to private investors. Jarrett Seberg is a policy analyst at Concept Capital's Washington Research Group. He says 1 year later, we're in a holding pattern when it comes to Fannie and Freddie.
We're waiting for the administration to figure out what they want to do with these two enterprises.
The government has already pumped almost $100 billion into Fannie and Freddie, and the Treasury Department stands ready with another $300 billion just in case. Even as the economy recovers, Seberg says pulling out of Fannie and Freddie is becoming harder because many private lenders aren't handing out mortgages like they used to.
Fannie and Freddie have become even more important in the last 12 months. As bad as the financial situation in this country got, it would have been infinitely worse if Fannie and Freddie weren't there providing the cash needed for the average person to get a mortgage.
When I told banking analyst Bert Ely that I was doing a story about Fannie and Freddie 1 year after the government takeover, this was his reaction.
Yawn.
He says that because he thinks it'll be years before the government decides what to do with Fannie and Freddie, at least, he says, until the housing market rebounds from coast to coast.
We don't have a crisis. They've been stabilized. There is no pressing need to do something at this time. But also, I would say there is no consensus at all over what to do with them in the future.
The ideas being floated by the Obama administration include creating a good bank, bad bank situation, where the bad assets would be guaranteed by the government and the good ones would attract private investors. Some are suggesting shrinking Fannie and Freddie or even shutting them down entirely. The administration is expected to unveil a plan in February. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Wall Street took the day off from its labors, but the rest of the world did not. We'll have details when we do the numbers. On Friday, the Labor Department issued the latest unemployment figures. You may have heard that another 215,000 workers lost their jobs just last month. More than half of those were in the construction and manufacturing industries, America's dirty jobs, if you will. Mike Rowe argues that we are all losing something as those jobs disappear. He's the creator, producer, and host of the Discovery Channel show Dirty Jobs. Mike's done everything from coal mining to maggot farming and far beyond. Last year on Labor Day, he launched a website called Mike Rowe Works, dedicated to the folks we're supposed to be saluting on this day. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tess.
May I ask what you are doing today, Labor Day?
I'm working. What are you doing?
I'm working, too.
What else would I do, Tess? I've worked. We've literally been shooting this show almost daily for the last 5 years. Today is a little more laid back. I do think there's going to be a frosty beverage in my future, maybe a barbecue, but there'll be work after that.
All right. Sounds good. Well, you launched this website a year ago dedicated to celebrating America's blue-collar work. Why?
My conscience was maybe a little troubled because Dirty Jobs has been really good to me, and it only works because regular people with regular jobs invite me into their homes, let me spend a day with them, basically shadowing them as an apprentice. And after a couple hundred of those, it became pretty obvious to me anyway that I was hearing the same stories week after week after week. And surprisingly, most of the people I met were having a better time than most of my friends. And you just don't expect to be on your belly in a sewer laughing. And yet, there I was. And I began to ask myself, and the viewers too, what might people with dirty jobs know that we don't?
Well, you talk on the website, you say that our society has slowly redefined what it means to have a good job. How and why do you think that happened?
You go in a bookstore and you look at the bestsellers, titles like The 4-Hour Workweek.
Mm-hmm.
You turn on the TV and you look at a typical portrayal of a plumber, and he's 300 pounds with a giant butt crack. And example after example, we see disparaging, simplistic, one-dimensional notions of work. And we begin to imagine the people who do these kinds of jobs in our mind's eye as very specific caricatures, and they're not.
What do you hear from the people that you work with in these jobs? Do they feel cut out from the national conversation?
I wouldn't say that the people that I work with feel excluded from a national conversation, but I would say that they see themselves as being in on the joke. And by the, you know, it's sort of an awareness, you know, that you find in the guy that picks up roadkill. He knows, for instance, that if he and his pals all call out sick for 2 weeks, interstate trucking and commerce stops. He knows this. You know, the statistics bear it out.
You mentioned early on that you have a pretty nice job. But I wonder, any of these dirty jobs that you think you might actually want to do?
I mean, I'm in awe of many of them, really. But my own personal biography, unfortunately, is not ideally suited to that pursuit. I grew up on a small farm in Baltimore, and my grandparents were next door, and my grandfather was one of those guys, born hardwired to build a house without a blueprint, to build an engine. He just knew how to fix stuff, and I didn't get the gene. and it actually drove me into entertainment because I was just tired of failing, at all of these typical blue collar jobs. But
now you
time,
get to do you know, all of them.
Now I don't know how to make it stop, Tess. 252 so far, but who's counting?
Mike Rowe is the creator, producer, and host of the Discovery Channel's great, great show, Dirty Jobs. Mike, it's been real fun talking to you. Thanks for being on the show.
Tess, I'm honored that you called, and back to work.
And we've got a link to the Mike Rowe Works website on ours. It's marketplace.org. The economy has forced companies all over the world to cut jobs. The number of announced layoffs has topped 1 million so far this year. That's according to the outplacement firm Challenger Grain Christmas. It's 60% more than at this point last year. Now, most of those pink slips are the result of money woes. There is just not enough of it to issue all those paychecks. But Sally Herships reports the recession is also giving cover to companies that want to get rid of employees just because.
Sadie Nardini managed a New York City yoga studio for the last 2 years. While there, she had to lay off 15 employees. That was half of the workforce. She was told to say it was due to the recession, except that wasn't the real explanation. Her boss had other reasons. Too many men at the front desk.
And she wanted some goddess energy up there, which means some women, apparently.
Or someone looked unhealthy.
Or this person talks too loudly.
Whatever the real reasons, Sadie's boss said to use the economy as an excuse. No one was given any notice. Even Sadie's mom. She worked for the yoga studio, too.
Did they fire your mother?
They fired my mother last week due to the economy. The economy is a scapegoat right now. It's dangerous a little bit.
David Lewis is a human resources consultant in Connecticut. He says on a scale of 1 to 10 for good excuses, recession is an 11.
It is that ripe and that rich for the opportunity to be able to let that individual go who you just haven't been able to figure out a way to let go before.
Lewis says there are many employers who have a worker they should have fired long ago. One example?
Where that person is older, does not have the skills necessary to do the job today. They may have had those skills when they joined the company some 20 years ago, but the jobs passed them by.
Dan O'Meara is a lawyer in Philadelphia. He represents employers. He says for employers, honesty is the best policy.
I think it's better that employers tell employees an uncomfortable truth than a flattering lie. Sometimes employers want to say, oh, this had nothing to do with your job performance, et cetera, et cetera, when in fact it did.
But what about lawsuits? O'Meara says use release agreements to soften the blow. That's a severance package in exchange for an agreement not to sue. But HR consultant David Lewis says that can be expensive.
Even there, you have no guarantee that the person's going to accept it.
Instead of a severance package, Lewis says employers may want to use the economy as an excuse.
Put them into a group of five people you're laying off, a lot easier.
When an employer is engaged in massive layoffs, proving that the reason for the layoff was discrimination rather than just financial distress will be more difficult.
That's Columbia University law professor Suzanne Goldberg. She says you obviously can't fire someone for race, gender, or religion. But both lawyers agree there are a lot of reasons you can legally fire someone. O'Meara says most U.S. workers are what's called employed at will.
Meaning the employer can fire them for good reason, bad reason, or no reason.
Which brings us back to using the recession as an excuse. Human resources consultant David Lewis says, while getting rid of deadweight employees may be a plus, no employer is happy to see their business shrink. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
And by the way, we've got a new feature at our website called Starting Over, where listeners are telling stories of how this recession forced them to dramatically change their lives. You can find them and share your own stories at marketplace.org. Coming up, work used to just be work.
in the UK and the US, we've moved towards a different system that really identifies work with the meaning of life. So you work for money, sure, but you work for deeper reasons, for identity, for self-fulfillment, for growth.
But first, let's do the numbers. The U.S. markets were closed for Labor Day today, but in Europe, things were looking up. Britain's Cadbury got a boost after it rejected that $16 billion takeover bid from Kraft Foods. The mac and cheese maker still wants a bite of the chocolate company and says it plans to pursue a deal. The London FTSE 100 jumped 81 points to close at 49.33, the biggest gain in about 2 weeks. Germany's DAX climbed 79 points, about 1.5%, to close at 54.63. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. President Obama addresses the nation's public schools, urging kids to stick with education. The speech will stream live on the White House website. Didn't get enough vacation this weekend? JetBlue's All You Can Fly program takes off. Customers that bought a pass can book unlimited flights for a month. And 35 years ago on September 8th, President Gerald Ford pardoned President Nixon for his role in the Watergate scandal. I'm Timothy Beckworth.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund in for Kai Rizdal. Recessions have a way of messing with people's plans. If you lose your job or your hours get cut, you probably can't take that vacation you've been counting on or fix that crack in the driveway. But for some couples, a bad economy is the perfect time for an addition, Tamara Keith explains.
A recession is a time to hunker down, work harder than ever, and avoid extra expenses. Oh, like, say, maternity clothes and diapers. Or is it?
I'm the baby.
You're the baby? Oh, you want to put it on my tummy like it's on the baby?
Yeah.
Sarah Steffens is preparing her almost 3-year-old daughter, Rosie, for the arrival of a baby sister. She admits the timing of this pregnancy may seem a bit unconventional.
Nobody's actually said this to me, but I'm sure that there's people I know who thought that this was some sort of a terrible accident or something.
Last July, Steffens, who lives in Oakland, California, lost her job. She was laid off by the newspaper where she had worked for 9 years. A blow like that would cause a lot of people to put their family plans on hold. But Steffens and her husband came to a very different conclusion.
I think we just decided, well, it's not going to be a great year for my career anyway, and we wanted the kids to be somewhat close in age, and, you know, why not?
Steffens has spent her pregnancy doing contract work, which is a pretty standard path for people who've been laid off. The flexible work schedule made it easier for her to coordinate all the doctor's appointments that come with pregnancy. And it gave Steffens time to think about what she wants to do next, since returning to a career in journalism doesn't seem like a particularly viable option.
I think it's a very clever decision.
Ellen Galinsky is president of the Families and Work Institute.
It gives you a break as long as you've got health insurance coverage or unemployment or some other source of income that you can depend on.
Galinsky isn't surprised that some women are choosing to weather the recession with motherhood.
This country is increasingly becoming family-centric. There is much more of an emphasis on children and families and being with them and taking good care of them than there has been before.
At this point, there are no solid statistics to tell us how the recession is affecting the birth rate. Stephanie Ventura, a demographer with the National Center for Health Statistics, says historically, in a serious economic downturn, births have fallen or flattened out. The latest data she has only goes through last July, so it's a little too soon to tell this time around.
Because it's kind of what you might call a lagging indicator, because it takes 9 months.
Ultimately, Ventura says the data will reflect a lot of different personal choices, those who put off pregnancy and those who went ahead in spite of the recession.
There's more than 4 million babies born every year, so that's a lot of decisions. And of course, there are some non-decisions.
The decision to have a recession baby just became a reality for Sarah Steffens. She welcomed little June Susan into the world 11 months to the day after she was laid off. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Author Alain de Botton likes to muse on the big topics in life. He's written sweeping tomes on love, happiness, travel, and now work. His latest book is The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work, and in it he explores why we love or hate what we do all day long. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, you know, there have been journalists who've gone behind the scenes in all kinds of different industries, philosophers who've pondered work, but your book is not quite either of those things. What did you set out to do here?
Well, it's a mixture of kind of philosophical journalism in the sense that I head out into the workplace, but rather than simply reporting on what I find there, I drive into the material certain really big questions that we all tend to ask ourselves of work, like where's all this headed, what's the meaning of it, what's the purpose, what are its upsides and its downsides. And the book has a very simple structure. It's made up of 10 chapters, each of which looks at a particular occupation, like logistics, power transmission, accountancy, rocket science, biscuit manufacture, the sort of jobs that people have in the modern economy.
I want to pick up on something you said, which is that this is the exploration of what is the meaning of work, what are its ups and downs, and, you know, frankly, those are the questions that we all ask about life in general. What does that tell us about how much work has become our lives?
Well, it's true that for most of recorded human history, work was something that people did, but it wasn't where they expected to put their center of meaning and their hope for a good life. But ever since about the middle of the 18th century, in the UK and the US, we've moved towards a different system that really identifies work with the meaning of life. So you work for money, sure, but you work for deeper reasons, for identity, for self-fulfillment, for growth. Not having a job, not being in employment, is a kind of shameful condition because you're lacking not only money but also an identity. If you go to a party and someone says, well, what do you do? You won't have an answer.
And I guess with so many people losing their jobs these days, how does that affect your relationship with work in general? Not just the place where you were laid off from, but the whole notion of work and a career.
Well, I think it all depends on how much you believe that the world is a meritocracy. I.e. a society where literally, if you're good, good things happen to you and you get to the top. And if you're bad, well, you might get to the bottom and you might be fired, etc. The world simply doesn't work that way. Luck, accident, biology, weather, chance, all these things are playing a huge part. I prefer to take my cue from religion. I'm a secular man, but there's a lovely bit in St. Augustine where he says somewhere that it is a sin, very strong word, a sin, to judge anybody by their post. We would mean by that by their job. The terrible thing about unemployment for many people is they feel horrendously judged. You know how all of us think there's something horrible and unacceptable about us? When we're unemployed, we think, somebody's discovered that horrible and unacceptable part. And my advice to anybody who's lost their job is, genuinely, it is not your fault. You know, we are not the center of everything that happens to us.
In one chapter, you write about cookie production, or biscuits, as you call them in England. And in that chapter, you talk about job titles and how specific our jobs are now. And on page 80, I'm wondering if maybe you could read from the paragraph at the bottom of that page.
Yeah. It's surely significant that the adults who feature in children's books are rarely, if ever, regional sales manager or building services engineers. They are shopkeepers, builders, cooks, or farmers, people whose labor can easily be linked to the visible betterment of human life.
So why do you think that is?
Well, we keep many things hidden from children, and I think one of the things we keep hidden from children is just how overcomplicated the world economy has become. Very few of us have these boldly defined jobs left anymore. Most of us are doing a tiny bit of a tiny bit of a tiny bit of a vast project. And I think that's a dispiriting thing to say to a four-year-old. I've not yet broken this dark truth to my four-year-old.
So what do you tell him your job title is?
Well, I say that I'm a writer, and he has a lot of conversations about, have I not thought about doing something more interesting?
Perhaps being a train conductor?
Yes, of course, or an astronaut. You can't understand that.
I want to ask you about your work. You are certainly not a cog in any sort of wheel. You are a writer. You know, you get to design your own work day. Have you ever had an experience of working in an office? And if so, did you like it?
I have. I've worked in a lot of journalist offices and a lot of television production offices, but what I haven't had is a sense of myself as an office worker for life, you know, with a pension scheme at the end and health insurance, etc. I've never felt owned by one large organization. I miss it. I sometimes have nostalgia and fantasies about what it would be like.
I could tell you all about it.
Well, you know, it's pretty scary in a way, being a freelancer. On a good day, it feels tremendously free. You feel like you really are designing your own life and succeeding at it. On a bad day, you think you're headed for disaster with no safety net. It's definitely a riskier sort of thing. But I think the pleasures and sorrows of work as a writer are quite similar to the pleasures and sorrows of a brain surgeon or somebody in a, you know, data office. You know, many of the same themes are there. It's, do you feel in control of the work you're doing? Do you feel it's making a difference? Do you feel it's being appreciated? All of these things, you know, work right across the board, whatever work it happens to be that you're doing.
Alain de Botton is the author of The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work. It's certainly been a pleasure having you as part of my work today. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasures, sorrows, we'd love to hear your thoughts about work. Write to us at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, we're all familiar with the cost of college these days. Tuition just keeps going up while students struggle to find jobs and loans. Well, Penn State is looking in every campus nook for a way to help. The university is asking the parents of students who were accepted into its honors program if they might be able to donate back a portion of the $3,500 merit scholarship that some students receive. So far, 11 have responded yes to the tune of $13,000. A similar effort last year generated more than $200,000 in donations. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the U.S. markets were closed for the Labor Day holiday. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Next time on the program, the Supreme Court weighs in on corporations and campaign funding.
In essence, you would be giving corporate America the capacity for dominance of our electoral and our decision-making process.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.